Hello and welcome to the Red Rock Fantasy Basketball Monster Podcast, brought to you by moneyball.com.au. My name is Josh Lloyd and you can find me on Twitter at redrock_bball. Today's podcast don't really have a set theme as such, but I am joined by a very special guest for today's podcast. I'm joined by Australian international cricketer Trent Copeland. Trent, how are you?
Going well, Josh. Yourself, mate?
I'm good. It's Friday here. Finished the week at work and now ready to digest a whole heap of basketball stuff and have a bit of a chat about basketball and sport in general with you, Trent. Now, Trent, you are, as I mentioned, you're an Australian international cricketer. You currently play cricket for New South Wales at the moment. You also do a bit of media work for ABC Grandstand. Let's give some of the stuff that you do a bit of a plug, where people can find you on Twitter and where they can hear you or see you plying your trade.
Yeah, I guess for me at the moment, we're right into the thick of cricket season. The New South Wales guys are actually playing on TV at the moment and doing really well. Steve Smith, another big 100. For those listening all about basketball, I guess Steve Smith at the moment is, you know, the Kevin Durant, the Anthony Davis, the Steph Curry of cricket at the moment. He's absolutely killing it every time he's out there. So great to see he's doing well today. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Copes9. You know, I'm generally talking fantasy sports, whether it's NRL, AFL in Australia, or NFL and basketball. So yeah, the radio stuff I'm really enjoying. The TV presenting is great fun as well. But just sort of mixing and matching while I was out injured last year, and sort of dabbled in a few different areas. It's good fun.
So how did you get involved with doing the media stuff? Obviously, you know, as an athlete, a lot of athletes get into the media, but is that something that you always wanted to do? Did you want to move yourself into the media, like when your career finishes, or is it just something that happened because you were injured and you thought, did someone approach you? Did you approach them? How did you get yourself into doing media stuff?
Yeah, well, I guess it came about the fact that I was injured played a big part. I was out for the season last year with a stress fracture in my back, which wasn't ideal. But they say you're never a fast bowler until you've had a stressy in your back. So tick that one off. But yeah, I got a call from Jim Maxwell and Ned Hall, who was a producer at the time from ABC Grandstand, talking about the Adelaide Test match. It was the start of the summer. We had the tragedy of Philip Hughes passing away around that same time, which meant the rescheduling of all the domestic games the same time as the Test match was on. And I just got the chance, you know, because I was basically someone that was interested in doing it. But basically everyone else was playing cricket. So it worked out really well.
So you know, bad timing in terms of the back injury, good timing in terms of branching yourself out into a different area of sport in terms of playing it or now broadcasting it. And everyone in Australia would know you and have heard your voice doing that sort of stuff last summer. And I think you'd be surprised, Trent, there are people who listen to this podcast in America who are big cricket fans, which shocked me. I know Eric Katuri, who is an NBA writer at RotoWire in the States, who I work with at RotoWire. He is a huge cricket fan. He started up the cricket department at RotoWire for fantasy cricket over there. So there are people in the States who listen to this podcast and follow the NBA who are cricket fans, which is always a little weird for me when I headed over to the States last year to watch some league. I met Eric over there, and a lot of the time we were talking about, you know, all-time favorite cricketers, which was such a weird conversation to be having while we're in Vegas talking basketball or watching basketball. So you do get some weird things happening.
Oh, no, yeah. Well, I mean, I've come across people all across the world that love cricket. You know, it is very much a world game. And there's a lot of expats playing in the States now. That I know in New York there's a fully-fledged league going on. And it's great to see that people over there care about it. Yep. I'm not sure they know me, but good to see they're following the game.
You never know. Some of them, I am sure there will be people in the States who do know of you and your cricketing exploits. We're not here to talk entirely cricket, though. That's obviously part of it, because as an elite sportsman, you have an insight into the lives that elite sportsmen lead and the way that they have the pressures that they're under in terms of, you know, we can relate it back to basketball and relate it back to the guys in the NBA. What do you find... I go on podcasts, I'll go out and say, this guy was terrible, this guy did this, and this coach didn't know what he was doing. But in reality, they're all people. And I said this a lot last year with players who had changed teams and were traded, that, you know, it's life adjustments for them for these things happening. How can you what sort of insight can you give into that with these people trying to live lives as elite sportsmen with media pressure on them? Is there anything that you can sort of, you know, give us an insight into in that sort of area?
Well, I guess the big thing for me that I noticed when I was playing for Australia, and it was only a very short time, I only played 3 test matches. I was involved with 2 test tours, one to Sri Lanka where I played my 3 games, the next one to South Africa, and I didn't actually play at home. My exposure was a little less than most on that scene. But the thing that I noticed the most was people at that level, you don't go out and intentionally have bad games, right? And everyone knows that.
Yep.
What sometimes I struggle to understand from a media perspective, and now having been involved in it and sitting in a commentary box listening to some people talk negatively about players, is the dealing with things like you say. I can't fathom in my head what a trade would be like in the NBA where the GM walks into the locker room and says, "Sorry, man, you're off to Utah," yep. Or, you know, "You live in Utah, sorry, man, you're off to the other side of the country," without too much notice, and you just got to ship off, and you're expected to perform at the same level, if not better, with a new franchise. So the insight that I can give is that whenever you are presented with a new challenge, you seem to lift. You when you're given challenges like coming back from an injury, going to a new team, needing to impress new teammates, fans, coaching staff, selectors, all those sort of things in cricket, it seems to bring out just that little something extra. We hear all the time about revenge games in American sport. Yeah. I think that's a great example of, you know, people that, and even in Australian sport, you know, Joel Selwood's 200th game this year comes to mind. You know, he was struggling for the first half of the year for Geelong, absolutely killed it in his 200th, and it spurred him on to a good finish to the season. So, you know, Andre Johnson in the States last week, you know, playing for India against his Houston side that he'd just been the last 10 years almost. Yeah. So, a huge game. These are the sort of things that play on players' minds. That little bit of extra motivation you can grab from somewhere is what pushes you on to succeed.
So, yeah, you're out there. Someone throws you the ball. You're about to bowl. If it's someone at the other end who is, say, you're playing for New South Wales and you're going up against Queensland, but the guy at the other end is a bloke that you're mates with, that you've played your juniors with, or whatever. Do you have extra motivation to go harder against a guy that you know, like that you have more of a friendly rivalry with, rather, or is it? Do you have the same feeling? The guy is an opposition. I'm going hard there. But if it's someone I know, you're going that extra, you push yourself an extra 5%, or is it any sort of thing like that?
Yeah, I think you get an element of that. Cricket is changing now with the T20 franchises coming in. Loyalty is going out the window a little bit. It used to be very much the old school culture of if someone was to move states, they were the hated. Yep. It didn't matter your personal relationship. They had abandoned you. Therefore, the rivalry on field used to be very heated. Nowadays, people are playing all across the world in different T20 franchises. People understand that, you know, if you move from New South Wales to Tasmania, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're turning your back on them. It's that maybe you're not getting the same opportunity, you know, that you could flourish in. And it's the same in any American sport as well. We see guys all the time. I'm sure, on your podcast in the last month, you're talking about preseason, you're talking about new opportunities for players, you're talking about, you know, injuries affecting roles for players. How many minutes are we projecting for this player? It's exactly the same in cricket. If I'm not getting a game in New South Wales or X player isn't, and they then move, I think the rivalry or the loyalty factor has gone out because everyone understands that we just want to pursue the end goal, and that's playing for your country, or in America, it's winning championships. So, I think, yes, it does play a part, but I think everyone is visible towards that end goal a little bit more.
I think that what you say there is perfectly, that's exactly what happens. And I think that the players all understand that. So you'll see things like, you know, a big example from the last offseason in the NBA was Brandon Bass. He played for the Celtics last season and then signed a free agent deal with the Lakers. And you saw when it was announced, yeah, Brandon Bass has signed with the Lakers. People, you know, Celtics, let's just call them dickheads, at their tweeting, "How can he dare abandon us? He's gone to..." he's gone to our hated rivals. Like, that's the... Yes, you play for one team and you hate the opposition. I'm going out there to beat them, but they don't have the same... You know, players don't necessarily... It's a little bit different in cricket, you know, if you're playing for your state because you grew up in that state. But as you said, people are moving around to different states all the time. The T20 stuff, you're just playing for a team to further your career, you know, and win with that team at the time. The players don't... You know, people get upset. Oh, look at the players. They're all friends. But it doesn't change the way that they compete. It doesn't have any impact on that. And you know, this is... It's fun. Sport is fun, but it's a business and it's a life for these guys. It's a life for you. So they're not taking it easy because they can go after the game and have a joke with someone. And I think people need to settle down with some of the stuff that they say, and the players should be having the same attitude that a lot of these fans do that isn't necessarily the most switched on opinion. We need to realize that these people are people. And as you said, someone comes into the locker room and goes, "Sorry, mate, you're off to the other side of the country. I don't just leave your wife, leave your kids, and you go somewhere and you got to play for a new team in 2 days with a whole bunch of people that you don't know, in a system you don't know, in a stadium you don't know, in different climate. It's a massive life change. If anyone had to do that in their life, they wouldn't cope. They wouldn't cope very well, I would imagine. And it translates into professional sport with millions and millions of people watching you do it, and then being ready to kick you when you're struggling. It's a big issue that I think that we really need to not pull back on, but understand the personal nature of. Now, as you mentioned, you had the two tours to Sri Lanka and South Africa. What's being on the road like? How does that affect your performance? Does it affect your performance at all?
It does, and I think the other thing is, you know, if there's exposure to people that you're overawed by, you know, I'm sure, you know, the American persona, I guess, or the stereotype is that everyone that's in the NBA belongs and they are the man and all of that. But, you know, I'm sure that, you know, if you're a young guy, a rookie, and you get traded, you know, to the Clippers, and you're all of a sudden you're on tour with Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan, Blake Griffin, you know, there's an element there that you're going to be overawed by. And, you know, for me, that was Ricky Ponting, Michael Clark, Mike Hussey, on tour with the Australian side. I've been watching these guys all my career, you know, and even childhood, thinking these guys are my idols. Now I have to call them teammates, and I also have to step up to the plate and perform straight away in foreign conditions. You know, let me give you an example, and for people that understand cricket, they'll get this, but when you go to a test venue a couple of days out, the groundsman is always on the wicket preparing whilst you train on the outfield. When we went to Sri Lanka for my first test, there were probably 8 fully clothed with headdress women sitting down on the wicket with a wire brush in one hand and scissors in the other, cutting the grass completely off.
Wow.
And then rubbing it down so that all the grass was dead on the wicket. You know, for me, I've never seen anything like that in my entire life.
That's weird.
You know, and so that is one little thing that I noticed, but you can only imagine in the States, you know, going to a city you've never been to, going to a city you've been to 50 times, but then coming across something in the locker room that's just a bit different. You know, I have no doubt even just dealing with away crowds, you know, heckling from the crowd. You know, when I was in the States, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in a minute, watching the Utah Jazz play at the home games in Salt Lake City, there was a guy who was maybe mid-60s, 70 years old, who must have bought his season ticket behind the ring, and he sits at the end with, like, all these things to, like, wave around and, like, this face that he puts on top of a witch's hat, and he waves it around, like, right behind the guy that's shooting for a free throw, and as well as the fans clapping and banging things together. So, you know, I can't fathom what that would be like, the pressure, you know, let alone being in the crunch moments of the game.
You can hear things, can't you? If you're out in the field, you can hear certain things in the crowd.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It becomes a little bit of just background noise.
Yeah.
And if anything, it lifts your adrenaline and sometimes you perform better. But there are times where, you know, someone will sing something out to you, and you hear it like they're standing right next to you having a conversation like we are right now. So, you know, you need to have pretty thick skin. And I imagine it's no different in the NBA because, you know, when there's that much money on the line that, you know, people that are fans, you know, pay good money to have season tickets and they've been fans for their whole lives, you know, some without championships the whole time, you know, I can understand how hard it would be.
Yeah, and I think that's really important for rookies especially. You mentioned going to a place they've never been to. These kids have gone somewhere, that they go to college, they might never have been to Milwaukee. They might never have been to New York City. Some of the rookies would have for the draft. They might never have been to Los Angeles. And they've got to go there, and you know, they get there, and then they've got to experience, how do I negotiate the nightlife? Are the teams going out? What do we do? Where are we in the city? Are you going to go to an unfamiliar stadium for the first time, play, you know, get change in an unfamiliar dressing room? I mean, as stupid as this sounds, it's different. I played sport at a much lower, I played cricket at a much lower level than what you did, Trent. But every time you went to a ground where it was different, you're like, okay, where am I going? Where am I putting my bag? Where am I sitting? Where's the toilet? Where do I get the drinks from? Like, where is it? Which you know, you go out, and this is again back to cricket, you go out to bowl, which end runs 1 degree uphill, which end runs 1 degree downhill? Where's the wind coming from? Unless you've played there two or three times, and it's happened for these things, like all these stadiums have different lighting, different sight lines, different angles, and if you're not aware of it, it's going to affect them, and it's part of a big struggle I think that rookies have, and a lot of rookies have massive differentials between what they do at home and what they do on the road. There's generally a pretty big split because it's just little things that make big differences when you're talking about elite athletes out there who are on top of their game. And you know, you're playing against LeBron, who's been doing it for 11 years, and he knows every arena like the back of his hand. And you go out there for the first time, not only are you intimidated and overawed by the experience, but now you've got to do something with, what's this sign flashing in the corner that I'm not used to seeing? Why is the scoreboard 5 feet to the left than where it would be at home? And there's just so many factors, and I'm sure you can attest to this, Trent, that athletes, they thrive on repetition and routine to really get them, you know, get their mental side of things going, and then when that leads to the physical actions as well.
Yeah, I agree, and I guess to a certain degree, talking about what you just referenced to there with LeBron, you know, my experience, which we may as well bring up now.
Yeah, let's
you know,
get into
I'm good friends with Joe Ingles through my wife, who plays netball for Australia. Joe's wife plays netball for Australia also. They're good friends. Congratulations
to those guys on winning the World Cup as well.
Yeah, great achievement. And Kim announced her retirement straight after the series, and she was absolutely ecstatic with how it went. But she also went to the AIS, the Australian Institute of Sport, with Joe Ingles when she was down there. So we're good friends. I went over last April to spend 2 weeks over there in Utah, in Salt Lake City, with a friend of mine, Curtis Patterson, who plays cricket for New South Wales. And we basically lived the life with Joe. We stayed with him, spent a bit of time with Dante and his old man. And just what you were talking about, when they played against the Cavs, you know, Dante's got great defensive hustle. They weren't so worried about his offensive struggles because of his value that he added on defense. And Joe, you know, for anyone that watched him last year, so good in running roles for the team, you know, whether it's, you know, the inbound pass in crucial moments or setting up defensive structures. He spent so much time on the sidelines talking to the coach, relaying messages. It was like the coach had really good trust in him. But against the Cavs, you're guarding LeBron James.
Yep.
Like, it's the first year for Dante. It's the first year in the NBA, albeit he's an experienced player in Joe Ingles. But I cannot begin to imagine what that's like. You know, talking to them, well, I can imagine from a cricket sense, but that would just be different level. You know, it would be like stepping up onto the first tee with Tiger at Augusta, you know, in his prime. It's different level. And I guys like Andrew Wiggins, who really killed it in his rookie year, you know, full credit to them, and they're going to be absolute stars if they can do it from the outset.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much that you don't really think about when you talk about what an NBA player's day is like. What did you see? Like, a day in the life of Joe Ingles, like what does an NBA player's day consist of? What do they do? What happens? I'm sure a lot of people would have no idea of what goes into a general day for these guys.
Yeah, well, I think it differs a lot. If they're traveling and they've got a hectic schedule, it is manic. They go literally, if they've got an away trip for the next day, you know, one of the days where we were there, so the first 4 days we were with Joe, he had home games with 2 days in the middle where he just, you know, we played FIFA, we looked around Salt Lake City, we, you know, had dinners at sushi joints. He took us around and saw the sights. But the games being at night, particularly where they are in Salt Lake City for timing, pardon me, and schedules and things like that, it's very hard to structure the day. They have shoot around in the morning, around 10, 11 o'clock. They do individual workouts with the coaching staff, work on the game plans. And then come the night time, it's all about getting a feed in just beforehand at the venue. And then when they get to the game, it's go time for 2 hours. And then straight away after, we went down into the locker room, spent a bit of time in the family room, meeting the players. They are all giants, by the way. Joe and Gordon Hayward play on the wing. And Curtis and I had a photo with them, and I'm 6 foot four and a half, and I was dwarfed by these two. Dante is easily my height. He's playing at the point. So, but the big thing I noticed is literally when they finish, they have, 10, 15 minutes with family. They talk a bit of shit in the locker room. Then they go do media. And then literally as you're walking out of the venue, their cars are all lined up, parked for them by the guy that does the valet. They drive straight to the airport, straight onto the tarmac, right next to the planes, like the movies. And park their cars, get on the flight, and they go straight to the next venue, which in our experience was Portland. They get straight on the plane, they're straight there, they arrive at say 2-3 in the morning, straight to the hotel, they get to sleep, they wake up the next day, do it all over again. They played that night against the Trailblazers in Portland, and then you've got to guard Lillard and Aldridge. It must be so hard for them, but it was great to experience it with him.
That's pretty crazy just to think that, okay, you've just played, then you go and fly, and you're getting in there. You hear these stories of them getting in at 3 or 4 in the morning, then they sleep, and they get up, and they shoot around, then they have a nap, and then they've got to be at their peak when everyone else is winding down. We get home, I get home from a day at work, and by 7 o'clock you're starting to wind down. That's when they've got to be up and they've got to be ready to go. Yeah. And the time zone difference as well, west to east coast. The guys coming from the east coast to the west coast, by the time they tip off at 7 o'clock, it's 10 p.m. back home. So they're gonna be peaking at 10 p.m. The game finishes at after midnight, and then they've got to travel. It's big, and then they go on these road trips where they're back and forward all the time. You can't really feel too sorry for them because obviously they're making millions of dollars doing it. But in terms of the stress it puts on the body and on the family, I imagine it's pretty significant what they have to go through in terms of commitments, team commitments, media commitments, family commitments, the travel, all that sort of stuff is it's really interesting to me. What else did you see over in Utah? Any other? What did you see from the team? Who were you most shocked by seeing? Like physically, anyone you went, like, this guy blows me away that he looks like this, or this guy's a freak and I didn't anticipate it. Who really sort of stood out to you when you were spending that couple of weeks with the Jazz?
Two guys who I'll talk about a little later when we talk about guys that I'm really high on this year in terms of fantasy, but. Alec Burks and Rodney Hood, two guys that one was playing a significant role towards the end of last year with a couple of injuries. But Alec Burks was injured out the season, but he was in his recovery phase. He was out on court doing layups and working out. Serious, freakish athlete, really strong build guy. And just his movement on court was just ridiculous. Rodney Hood, on the other hand, was turning it on court as well. So, those two guys really shocked me in that sense. One that shocked me with his presence was Rudy Gobert. in the locker room when we went down after the game. We're walking out, and funny story, actually, I had my phone out, and Curtis Patterson, who was with me, we were walking with Joe. We're about 15 metres behind Rudy in the walkway to go out towards the car park. And Curtis is walking behind me going, I tell you what, geez, I'd love to dunk over Rudy. I was like, go on then. Yeah, you're never going to be on an NBA court as good as you think your jump shot is. So I got my Snapchat out. He started walking in front of me, walked up about as close as he could get to Rudy without making him aware, jumped up and then like fake dunked on top of him. And I got it on video. And Rudy turned around and was like, what the hell are you doing, man? Three tall white guys in the corridor going, what's going on?
That's awesome, man.
So he was huge, man. Like, I've never seen anyone that big in my life. And his arms were, like, down to the floor.
Yeah, it's pretty weird just to be around guys that are not only that big, 'cause sometimes you might see a person that big, but that big and that coordinated and athletic and quick, yeah, and everything. It's just it's a pretty weird experience, and I don't think I would have had the balls to run up and dunk on Rudy Gobert with his back turned. No chance.
No, but the other guy that really shocked me, and this was in a really good way, was Marc Gasol. The Jazz played against the Grizzlies in a home game, and we went down afterwards and we were just chilling out with Joe. He walked past in the corridor, and they played when Joe was playing in Barcelona.
Yep.
Mark was over there in preparation for, I think it was the Olympic Games, with his brother. And they came in and trained with Barcelona, recovering from an off season. So they had a really good rapport together. They were, cracking jokes. And KP and I got to have a 5-minute chat with Marc Gasol about, just where we were going for the night, what we'd been up to, what he's been up to, all these sort of things. And he was just really fun to be around, cracking jokes. For a big guy and so successful, such a serious player, I was really shocked at how humble he was and, how keen he was just to meet two new people and have a joke. So there's a bit of man love there for Marc Gasol.
Everything I've seen about Marc Gasol and heard about him and seen from him makes me think he's probably top five blokes in the NBA. Everything I've heard about him, nobody has ever said a bad word about Marc Gasol. Everybody that meets him loves him. I mean, when I had Matt Moore on the podcast doing the Grizzlies preview, he was glowing in terms of what he said about Marc Gasol. Teammates love him. Just a fantastic guy, and it's always great to hear those stories. Where sometimes you hear a lot of negative about people being real bastards and selfish and all that sort of stuff. But everything you hear about Marc Gasol is, and it helps that his game is very aesthetically pleasing as well. Like it's awesome watching Marc Gasol, and he's a great guy to go along with it. So I think that's really it's really cool, and it's cool that you had that experience to go over there and hang out with these guys and get an insight into the NBA life and some of the stresses and what they have to go through. I think it's something I'm probably never going to get that opportunity. Most people listening to this podcast are never going to get that opportunity, and I think it's a pretty decent insight into that sort of stuff. Now, Trent, you're a fantasy basketball nut as well. You're always tweeting stuff to myself and then to Seth. Heaps of the guys on Twitter. You're in a league with myself and Seth that we drafted last weekend. Me and Seth spoke about that the other day on the podcast a little bit. You had the pick just before me, and to say that I was cursing you during that draft would be a little bit of an understatement, because you were taking every single guy that I wanted. It felt like you were in it's a relatively competitive league with a decent sort of buy-in, nice prizes at the end of it. What was your thought process heading into this league? You had pick 8. You went with Russell Westbrook, who fell to you at pick 8, which I think was it's a massive steal for you to get him at pick 8. But how did you formulate your strategy, and what made you come up with the strategy that you were going to go with?
So I had a couple of game plans in mind, and this is the first year where I've really got heavily involved with cash leagues and tried to really take it to the next level as opposed to just playing for fun.
Yep.
And obviously I'm still playing for fun, but
of course,
playing guys like yourself, like Seth, that are living and breathing this stuff is a good challenge for me. I'm really keen to see, if I can take it on. And I had a bit of a game plan in mind around the fact that I thought one of four guys would get to me. I thought it would be the Westbrook, Cousins, LeBron or maybe Chris Paul, because this league doesn't have turnovers and it's got double doubles as a category. So I figure that some of those guys may slide up in front of Chris Paul. And then I had a strategy around all four of those guys. I've heard you talk about, you know, planning out in advance, you know, if you end up with player X in round one, you know, what's your ideal person for the next round, or what are three or four guys that you'd love to have in the next round? So I had about, you know, four or five guys in a list straight after Westbrook, after he'd slipped to me, about possible strategies that I'd go towards. The punt free throw one was the obvious one and the easiest one to execute, I think, for people who are just starting punting. I've been doing it for a couple of years, but certainly not to the level that any of you guys would have been doing. With me being just before you in the first round, that meant I was just after you in the second round, and the guy I was hoping to get was Rudy. So I was a little bit disappointed about that, but that obviously meant that DeAndre was on the board, and he was my second pick. So from there, it was pretty much a given that I was going hard after maybe another point guard in the next round, in which I got Oladipo. And then from then on, it was all about the double-doubles category and punting free throws.
I think that's really important what you mentioned about the double-doubles, and it goes back to one of the major things when looking at your draft is to understand your league and to understand the settings in your league, because adding that double-double category, and I spoke about this when talking about this league the other day, is that the guys that I pick with my first four picks, I pick two point guards, but they're the two point guards who are probably going to be the two of the top three point guards in terms of getting double-doubles, because not many point guards get double-doubles regularly. So I got John Wall and Reggie Jackson with pick one and pick three for me, because I wanted to make sure I got double-doubles. You know, I got Gobert and I got Dwight Howard. You know, I was punting free throws, obviously, as well, but I wanted to get double-doubles. And you've gone there with DeAndre Jordan, who's going to get you double-doubles. Westbrook's going to get – he's one of those point guards. He's probably one of the top point guards in terms of getting double-doubles and even triple-doubles. It makes a big difference. Like, to pick – LeBron went one pick ahead of you. LeBron's not a guy who's going to – he doesn't get as many double-doubles as what you might think he does. He's more of a 25-5 and 25-7-7 guy.
But yeah, agreed.
The double-double makes – and that obviously played a huge part in some of the decisions you made in grabbing some of these players. And I think that's really important to note, that when people are drafting, to understand what your league's about, understand where there's a difference from standard. Because you can go out there and look at rankings. You can look at my rankings on Basketball Monster. You can look at anyone's rankings anywhere. But it's different. Like, you might have 14 teams in your league, and that changes things as well. You might have double-doubles. You might have assist to turnovers. You might be 8 category, 9 category, 10 category. You might have fouls. Whatever it is, everything changes it, and you've got to make that adjustment in your mind. Now, I think you did really well in this draft, Trent. If you look on Basketball Monster, you've seen the projected standings tab. Your team comes out as fourth. My team comes out as first, but that's partly because of, you know, that's partly because I did the projections and I'm drafting based on that. So if my team wasn't quite up there in terms of who I was drafting, I'd be pretty disappointed. But you came in at fourth, and Seth came in at third on these projected standings. But you've gone with a similar route to me. Except you're really strong in threes, which I think it's not easy to do when you're punting free throws, and then also get a really strong team in steals and threes, which is what you've done too. You've got big blocks, big field goal percentage, big rebounds, and I think you've structured your team really, really well. You've ended up punting three categories in the end, but I've got no problem with doing that, especially when you know what you're doing and you're approaching it in the correct way, which is what I think you've done, and you've come out really well. I reckon you're going to be a really competitive team this season in that draft and that on this league. This league was a really fun league last year. I was the runner-up in it last season, and it is super fun. And be prepared for Seth to send you crazy. Has he sent you a trade yet?
He hasn't, but he's spoken to me about it. I'm prepared fully for when the season starts to get a trade offer a day from him. But I'm normally that guy in my league. So,
oh, you are. Okay.
You know, I spent in my time while I'm injured from cricket last year, I'm sitting there working out how I can get a slight upgrade with a 2-for-1 or, you know, things like that. But, yeah, the great thing about what you're just talking about, and I've got to say, for anyone listening who's worried about drafting or not quite sure about how to structure things, the Basketball Monster facility with Draft Tracker was awesome for me.
It's so good.
It just clarifies things when you know, I'm sure everyone listening knows what I'm talking about, when you say, when you're under the pump and the clock is ticking down and the person before you or the person two spots before you has taken who you wanted, there is nothing more frustrating than not knowing who you want next.
Especially when you hear that noise. When you hear that, the noise, the beep, 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 to say you got like 5 cents. Oh my God, who am I going to pick? Is it going to auto draft this guy at the top? I don't want Dwayne Wade at pick 40. Like, I don't want this guy. You have to be prepared.
I totally agree. And the thing you said that I ended up being good in steals and threes, which is hard for this punt strategy. But the reason I was to a large degree because you took guys like Rubio, Reggie Jackson, Michael Carter Williams in picks just before me. I was structuring it around going heavy assists.
Okay.
But I then needed to realize that you're punting free throws also during the draft. It's too late to worry about it later. I think you've got to be aware of other people's structures and what they're trying to do, because then it might mean you need to reach a little bit more for guys that you really want on your team. Forget the rankings, throw them out the window.
Exactly.
Because for your build and you being strong in the categories you want to be strong in, like Reggie Jackson, man, I had him at like 65, which was probably conservative, but you've taken him where I should have been that aggressive on him because I know how good he is at the double-double category and the things that I wanted him to be good at. So missing out on Rubio, who I'm really high on this year, if he can stay healthy. I'm obviously a little bit biased as a Wolves fan, but Michael Carter-Williams and a few other guys like that, when I missed out on them, I went for guys like Terrence Jones, who's a little bit of a different route. I know he's poor free throws, but I'm hoping that he plays a big role this year. I went Covington, who I'm really
That's a massive big on steal. This year.
He's a great player. Danny Green in the middle rounds. I wasn't big on targeting wings because they just don't bring in double-doubles. But hopefully, Covington and Danny Green can provide those extra three-pointers that will maybe, when I'm playing against you, our categories are very similar that we punted, that can maybe give me the edge.
You got Robert Covington to pick 104, which is probably the biggest steal of that entire draft. It is superb. He is a top 60 player. I was punting threes as well, so he lost a lot of his value to me. But still, I was tempted when it was coming to my pick at 105 that I can't let this guy go who's going to hit 2.5 threes a game. He's going to grab 6 rebounds. He's going to be a 1.5 steals guy. That's the sort of pick that can win you a league, getting that, because he is able to shoulder the responsibility of threes for a lot of the players on your teams. He can do it for steals as well, and he enables you to... Those other picks you've made, he enables those picks to actually work and to come through. So I'm that's a super pick that you made there. Now,
I'm happy with the team, how it worked out. What about you? I know we did a similar punt strategy, and I think from memory you've only got one wing on your whole roster. Al Farouk, I think.
Sounds like me. Let's have a look at my team. Bring it up. Sometimes I go a little aggressive.
Yeah, but with the double doubles involved and no turnovers, I saw you went heavy point guard, heavy center, power forward, guys that are going to get lots of rebounds, lots of assists, lots of points, and they're things that are so hard to catch up. I've heard you say it so many times. You can't catch those things up late in the draft.
Yeah.
When you had done that, I was stuck. I couldn't get that stuff late on. So I think, if there's a message out there for people who are drafting in the next week or so, go after the guys, forget the rankings, go after the guys. There's nothing worse than seeing a guy you are high on and you've got marked down on your notepad before the draft, oh, I want this guy, and then seeing him win the championship for another guy in your league. There's nothing worse.
Let's hope that happens. But what you said is key in terms of throw out the rankings, and I say this all the time. Once you get past the first couple of rounds, the next 50 guys are the same, and they're only different because of what you need. So if Reggie Jackson's the 50th, if he comes out at the end of the season and Reggie Jackson is the 50th ranked player, I don't care, because for what he gives me, he was ranked probably 25th for what I needed at that point. And so many, look, I grabbed Mason Plumlee pretty early because I wanted to grab, really solidify my field goal percentage, really solidify my double doubles, and I grabbed him at like 88 or something like that, which is probably going to sound crazy high, but if he goes 12 and 10 and gives me a steal and a block and 60%, and he gives me nice double double, and I don't care. That's exactly what I need from him, and that is a key point to throw out the rank, not even throw them out, but you have an understanding of where other people might look, but jump ahead, go two rounds above, and don't hold on completely because I need to get value. I need to get a steal of the draft, because it's not a steal if he ends up on someone else's team.
Yeah, and I think the great thing about rankings and you know, essentially having a player list sitting there in front of you is good for a player to slap you in the face if you've just plain out missed them.
Yep.
I think that's the way to go. You know, if there's a guy, like you said, if Covington, is sitting there at 104, you can't let that go past. And pre-rankings will at least have that guy sitting in front of you so that you don't miss him at that point. So, yeah, but other than that, I think you're spot on.
All right, now people have heard me go on about the players that I love for this season, the players that I don't necessarily love as much. But for you, for someone who's not, say, working in the industry, but is doing it as a big fan of the NBA and a big fan of fantasy sports, who are guys that you really like this season and players that you don't like this season?
Yeah, well, the first one that I think a lot of people in fantasy circles are a little bit down on because of the efficiency that he's going to lose. And also the parts and the pieces that are moved around him. But it's Damian Lillard. I think if he's not top five or six value at the end of the year, I'll be shocked, particularly in 8-cap leagues. I watched him in person last year, which has probably played a little bit of a role in my ceiling that I think he does have, because watching him warm up, watching the class this kid has.
It has an impact, definitely. To see them in person has an impact.
And his longevity, you know, and he's played every game, I think, for the last three seasons. I think you could probably correct me there.
No, I think that's right. No, I'm sure that's right.
Yeah, so his durability is there for me. There's no injury worries. He is going to, if he wants to take, you know, 40 shots a night, he could take 40 shots a night if he wants to, you know. But I think he can take his shooting to a new level. You know, I'm not really basing that on anything other than the fact that, you know, his first couple of seasons, this kid is an all-star already, and he's going to be for the next, you know, 10 years. I have no doubt about that. The thing that worries me is maybe his assist column, you know, whether that can be as good without Aldridge, you know, nailing them from everywhere. The same pieces like Wes Matthews and Nicola Batum, you know, on the wings, but I'm confident in the pieces they've added that, you know, they'll be good enough around him to be the focal point. And if you're tossing out things like turnovers and occasionally you're in the punting strategies with percentages, I just cannot see how you can go past him in the first, you know, 12, 13 picks.
I've just redone the projections lately, and I don't remember where I've got him, but it depends. If you're punting field goal percentage, then he rises significantly because I think he is going to take a hit because he's going to take so many shots. Now, he might actually be a better shooter percentage wise, but if you shoot less than say 47%, or maybe not 47, maybe it's about 46%. If you shoot less than 46%, the more attempts you take, the worse it becomes. So you could be a guy who shoots 44%, but if you take 24 shots a game, that's going to be worse than a guy who shoots 43% on 7 shots a game.
Yeah.
So if you're below average on big volume, that's what's going to hurt him. So I'm just going to have a look at where I've got him re-ranked at the moment, because I redid them. I've got him in 8-cat leagues. I've got him at 11th for head-to-head leagues. I think that we know he's going to score. He's going to hit a lot of threes. And again, you have to know what he's going to do. He's not a high assist guy. He's not a high steals guy, but he's going to give you points, which are really hard to get. He's going to give you big free throw percentage, which is really hard to get. And you can build around that. You can grab, then, you know, you can get Reggie Jackson in the third round and get yourself assists. You can grab, you know, a steals guy. You can grab an Eric Bledsoe or Victor Oladipo there to get the steals up. You can grab, you know, Covington later on and really lock down your three. So he's going to have tremendous value. But again, it's got to be in a way that you build around it correctly. Who else do you like? Anyone else that you really love?
I'll just tell you, in my main cash league that I do every year, I took Cousins in the first round, followed by Lillard. And then after that, I've got people like Bledsoe, Ariza, Kemba Walker, Ricky Rubio. So building a punt field goal percentage strategy around someone like Lillard, I feel like, you know, he is priceless in that build.
Oh,
so
definitely.
I think he's going to be a superstar. The other guys I've got written down, Ricky Rubio, I think everyone is down on him because
I'm not. I love him.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love the guy as a Wolves fan. I think the Wolves in general are going to be quite strong this year. They might surprise a few people, I think, with particularly the depth they've got in most positions. You know, I'm not sure how long Zach LaVine will stay in the starting lineup, but, you know, aside from that, Ricky Rubio, for me, if he stays healthy, is, you know, going to challenge guys like, you know, Chris Paul and John Wall for assists per game. He's going to challenge guys for the leading steals per game. And I think, you know, I can't see shooting being as bad as what it has been in the past, but that's just a hunch. And I'm really big on him. I think he's the kind of guy you can get in the seventh, eighth, or even lower round. And he's the kind of guy I think can win you a championship in fantasy. So, you know, him along with Bradley Beal, Nicola Batum, and the obvious one, CJ McCollum, I think he's going to be a star. When I was there watching them play against Utah this year, you know, he was playing that game, and that was after Wes Matthews had gone out of the side. Aaron Aflalo was injured. He played a significant role, and this was the start. When I was there, this was the start of the hype train, I think, in my opinion. He started nailing shots. He started playing a bigger role, and they saw what they had in this kid. And I own him in a couple of leagues. I missed out on him in our one that we did together, but I'm with everyone else, so I think this kid's going to be an absolute star.
Anyone else? Anyone that you're sort of a bit down on?
Yeah. Well, I've got a question for you that okay. You know we're going to maybe get to in a little while, and that's out of the top 24 players. Maybe I'll give you a heads up so you can think about it now as well. So the top two rounds of fantasy in 12-team leagues, they're the guys that everyone puts their stock in to take them home. You know, they're the guys that they build teams around. In NFL fantasy this year, I could tell you, you know, there's probably 15 of the top 24 people that were taken off the board in the majority of leagues that are absolute busts, be it injured, roles have changed, had a niggle, sat out one game, another guy's jumped them in the depth chart, killed it, things like that. And it's just turned the whole season on its head in NFL. I'm interested to hear what you think about the top 24 and maybe two or three guys that you think out of there that are going to be busts, that are going to, you know, let people down on that draft stock. For me, I think, you know, there's a lot of players that are going really early. And I guess that's to do with strategy and what punt build you're going with, or even sometimes just taking players that you really love. But for me, just scrolling down the Yahoo O-Rank list here, I think Jimmy Butler, I know you're a Bulls fan. Okay. I don't think...
I'm with you on Butler. I don't want him. I don't want him that high.
Yeah, and I know a few people are down on Aldridge as well. I think he's probably going to struggle, whether it's just minutes coming down, and the way that Popovich loves to spread out that offense, spread out the roles. I think that's probably going to play a bit of a part as well. But the big one for me, I think, is Kevin Durant.
Yeah, me and Matt talked about it yesterday.
I haven't listened to that podcast yet, but yeah, I think what people don't realize, and maybe this is just my experience as being an athlete, certainly not comparing myself to Kevin Durant, by the way, but
the Kevin Durant of New South Wales cricket.
In coming back from injury, you know, it takes you a while to feel your way. It takes you a while to get back to who you were, the confidence to go in a contest and hard at the ball, you know, in terms of steals, things like that. His strengths around his shooting feel, we saw with Batum last year, that little niggle in his wrist, it just killed him because he had no confidence to get through that. I think with Kevin Durant, not only him coming back from an injury, but the success we saw Westbrook have last year, Ibaka will no doubt have a role on offense. Kanter wasn't there when Durant was killing it in the past 4 years. I think, you know, the big thing we're going to see is there might be a bit more of a spread in that offense than we think.
I agree with all of those. Butler, I love Jimmy Butler, but he took such a massive leap last year, and people then are then projecting him to be even better this year. I'm not buying that. LaMarcus Aldridge, I've never been a fantasy fan of, but me and Matt spent, I reckon, 5 minutes talking Kevin Durant last night, and just in case anyone hasn't heard that, go back and listen to it. But we went through his preseason stats comparing him to Russell Westbrook, and his numbers were putrid in comparison. Like, he's not getting any rebounds, any assists, no steals, no blocks. His percentages, his free throw percentage was like 67% on like 4 or 5 attempts, which is so un-Kevin Durant like. And that and this is something that I've stressed a lot, and I'm glad that I'm hearing it from you as an athlete, is that coming back from injury, it's not like, oh, injury's fixed, let's go, it's back to normal. It's not. I had that experience for myself. You know, I played cricket as well. I had a lot of injuries as a bowler. And when you come back, you go, is it going to happen again? Like, do I have to adjust my body? I haven't been doing this for so long. I'm in a different environment. What's going to happen when I move this way, when I move that way? And hearing it from you puts extra faith in my thought that I am worried about Durant, and I'm probably not picking him. And I'm worried about Paul George, because that was a horrific injury. That was a sickening injury. And it's not like, yeah, you broke your bone, put plaster on it, you know what, get back out there. No, you broke your bone, you snapped both of them, they penetrated through the skin, and now you got to go back and do the same.
Yeah.
You can't have confidence in it. Maybe next year. Injuries take, and serious injuries take 2 years to get fully back from. And we'll say, yeah, no, Kevin Durant's back. No, Paul George is back. Yeah, they're back, they're playing, but they're not Kevin Durant. They're not Paul George. They're injury return 75% back, and it takes so long to come back from mentally.
I agree, yeah, and the mental side of it, but also, you know, the strategy around managing players that are coming back from injury, if they get a knock or something around that same area happens, the caution that will be in play will be sitting back-to-backs out for a couple of weeks, or it'll be a rest like LeBron had last year for 2 weeks to make sure they get, if they're sitting pretty and working towards playoffs, do we see Kevin Durant sit out? The crucial part in fantasy. Like,
yeah, it's possible.
That's the stuff I'm worried about. And I'm notoriously a fantasy skeptic. But I think you won't see me with Durant or George on any of my teams this year.
No.
What I'm not saying though is that they're going to be disasters. I think that they're both going to be very successful when they're on the court, and they'll still be, you know, top two, at worst, top three round players. But, you know, I just think maybe their numbers across the board just dip a little bit. The one thing I will say is preseason, you know, you can't ever read into preseason the full story. And I'm sure everyone is aware of that to a certain degree, but I have no doubt Kevin Durant will be going into these games wanting to get his shot right, and that'll be his only focus because he knows the other stuff might come.
Yep.
You know, George has gone the other way. He wants to take a million shots, get rebounds, get full on into it to test his body to see if he's right to go. You know, I don't know whether we can judge on George's usage rate right now without all the pieces around him that he's going to be a star and he'll be back to his best. Or on the flip side, that Kevin Durant will be an absolute disaster. But what we're saying is, I think you just need to take caution and don't reach for those kind of guys.
Yeah, look, you're saying exactly the things that I have thought and said about these guys, is they're not going to be bad. They're not going to be terrible players, but there's more of a risk of them having an issue. And if Kevin Durant comes into the locker room or walks into the facility one day limping and go, you know what, my foot's a bit sore, the whole organization's going to shit itself, and they're going to be going, no, and
yeah, like,
stop walking, sit down, grab a wheelchair, go and have a scan, take the time off, go home, do whatever. They will be petrified because they want to win. They don't want him to leave the franchise without them winning a title. So they'll want to make sure they win it this year, and they'll want to make sure that anything happens. Same with Paul George. He'll go home at nights, and he'll have, I don't know if you've ever had any sort of broken bones in your lower body, but he'll have aching there. He'll have an aching leg. And it will happen a lot. And he'll be like, oh, my leg doesn't feel quite right. And it plays on your mind. Like, athletes, so many athletes are sensitive mentally. That's not a criticism of them, but they are, because they're as good as they are. They have supreme confidence, but then they have a lot of doubt with certain things that they do as well. And it's going to creep into their thoughts as well. I've got no doubt. So those two guys, Yeah, I don't think I did pick Durant in a dynasty draft, but that means because I'm looking for the next couple of seasons, and I think he'll be fine by next season, assuming there's no setback. Yeah. I just don't think he's going to be Kevin Durant this year. As a Timberwolves guy, I put this question out there on Twitter the other day, and the results were pretty overwhelming to me. But I want to hear your thoughts: Andrew Wiggins or Karl Anthony Towns, who will be the better player over their career?
I think, as a Wolves fan, I want to preface this by saying that I am just absolutely thrilled that these two guys are going to be long-term Wolves players. You know, hopefully that's the case, because, you know, these two, to go with the other pieces that they've got, I think, you know, with KG there to play a role and help usher Towns into, you know, what will be hopefully a massive career, I honestly cannot wait to watch it. There's another, you know, Deng, I'm excited about LaVine, Rubio being back to full health, hopefully. All these guys, it excites me. Back to your question, I think it's got to be Towns.
Yep.
I just think that this guy is just freakish talent. His efficiency at the moment in preseason is, you know, quite surprising to me that he can just step in and go to that level. He's not overawed by the big man he's playing on, albeit in preseason. But he comes across as like Wiggins did last year. It may take him a month or two, but I think you can back this guy in to be a solid point scoring, rebound, double-double guy every night with blocks. And I think he's going to be a presence on both ends of the court.
That was the overwhelming response I got. Now, we haven't seen, obviously, him play in a regular season game yet, but everyone was on board with Towns being the better player than Wiggins, and that's not detracting anything from Wiggins, but Towns has the potential to be a defensive game changer as well. I think he had 3 blocks in their last preseason game. I think that it's Towns as well as the better player, but you know, we could be talking better players in Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen sort of, you know, differentiation. Like, Pippen's an all-time great, but he's behind Jordan. I'm not saying Towns is Michael Jordan, but that could be the sort of differentiation we're talking there. Now, Trent, you had a question for me before about who I think out of the top 24 will struggle. And we covered 2 of them already. Yeah, Kevin Durant and Paul George are 2 guys that I don't want to deal with in that top 24. The other guy is another guy I mentioned on yesterday's podcast who I am worried about a little bit, and that's Rudy Gobert. Because, yes, he's going to get good rebounds. Yes, he's going to get good blocks. Yes, he's going to get good field goal percentage. But you, like, I drafted him in that league with you and with Seth. You have to build around his lack of points. He's not going to score more than 11 points a game, most likely. And he's verging on a free throw punt guy. Me and Matt discussed this yesterday, that he's at 50% through the preseason on like 4 attempts a game. So 3.5 attempts in 20 minutes, which is massive. Yeah. And that translates to Dwight Howard-ish numbers almost. And people who drafted him in the early second round, like at 12 or 13, that sort of area, and thinking, I can get blocks from a guy who's not going to be a free throw killer, it's going to affect a lot of teams who aren't prepared for that. Because if he goes in and shoots, you know, 59, 61% on 5 or 6 attempts a game, which the numbers are looking that way in preseason, it might not continue. That's a real worry to me. So unless I'm really set up for it, unless I'm punting points, and free throws, to be honest, it's going to be really hard for Rudy Gobert to have to return the value of people picking him at 12. Now, I'm okay with him towards the back end and in that situation where you're punting those categories, but if you're at the back end of the second round, 18, 19, 20, 21, that sort of area I'm okay, but it's more the 12, 13, 14 area where I'm getting scared with people taking him. So there's 3 guys there that may struggle to live up to what a lot of people are expecting. That's Durant, Paul George, and Rudy Gobert, for all the reasons that we spoke about. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do, mate. And I think the overwhelming feeling and message that I was getting out of that group while I was over there was, and you know, even talking to Joey in this off season, Gordon Hayward is going to go to new heights this year.
He looks amazing.
Absolute superstar. You know, he had surgery in the off season, minor surgery, but you know, everything they're seeing and talking about is about him taking it to a new level. And the most underrated fantasy commodity, and also I think player that the Utah Jazz have in general, Derek Favors.
Yep, agree.
He is extraordinary for his age, you know. And I met him and spoke to him in the locker room. Oh, sorry, the family room on one of the nights. This guy is so calm, so collected, but they're talking about his jump shot moving out, his range moving out. When I was there watching him in warm-ups and things like that, he's got an unbelievably smooth shot. I think he's going to go to new heights playing alongside Rudy for the entire season. Last year was a little bit interrupted with mixing around minutes for both he and Cantor. I think this year when they can solidify that relationship, the inside presence on defense, his block numbers with Rudy, I think he could even go up in that category. And his rebounding rate, I can't see it not improving as well.
Yeah, I agree. That Favors is tremendously underrated this season. You can get him pretty late. You can get him outside the top 50 in certain situations, and that's a massive steal. And I agree with you. I'm a huge Gordon Hayward fan. I think he's a great fantasy player. I think he's a massive chance this season, and it's hard in the West. I think he's a massive chance to be an all-star this year. He looks massive. He looks ripped. He has got, you know, Hulk Hogan's 24-inch pythons happening at the moment. He can do everything. He can shoot. He can rebound. He can pass. He can play defense. Huge Gordon Hayward fan. So both him and Favors underrated.
Yeah, too many mouths to feed for Rudy to be, you know, upping that points tally, in my opinion. His rebounding, I think, will still stay strong just because of the wingspan, the presence he's got in there. But, yeah, I get what you're worried about, and I'd be worried about it too, particularly if the free throws, if they get worse, we could, you know, that could be a legitimate game plan down the other end. So for teams defending him. So, you know, who knows if we see a Hacker Jordan or a Hacker Shaq strategy on the Utah Jazz.
It definitely could happen. Do you have any other questions for me, Trent?
I was just going to ask you a couple of fantasy relevant questions about one situation that is absolutely diabolical at the moment is the Celtics big men. I'm sure, you know, all the hype is around the fact that, you know, the chat that's coming out of there is about David Lee is impressed. They're going to run some of the offense through him. We know he's good with the ball in his hand and can pass well. So I'm locking him in as one guy that's out of that four or five that is going to be there. Who are the others? I'm sure everyone, there would even be, you know, Zeller would be on most waiver wires. Salinger is on a lot of waiver wires. Two guys that can be extremely fantasy relevant given the minutes. You know, the other guys that are around there, what is your take on that whole situation?
Yeah, my take is that it's confusing. And David Lee, I wasn't big on him in the offseason, but what we're seeing and what the word coming out now is, yeah, they're going to run with him and he's going to probably get the bulk of the minutes there. So he becomes a guy that you probably have to own in all 10 and 12 leagues, team leagues, David Lee. Tyler Zeller apparently is going to be starting next to him, and he's a really efficient big man. He's going to get low turnovers, good field goal percentage, good free throw percentage, decent blocks, decent rebounds. He's not a must-own guy, but he's going to have some value. If Amir Johnson's coming off the bench, I don't think I want much to do with him. He's, you know, barely ownable if he's starting and playing 30 minutes. If he's playing 25 minutes, I'll stream him in if necessary, but I'm not going to be spending draft picks on grabbing Amir Johnson. The guy that it really upsets me about in Boston, go.
Sorry, mate. I was just going to say four of my leagues, people went out and jumped on Amir Johnson yesterday after his game in preseason. I'm sitting back thinking to myself, what are you doing?
No, exactly.
You know, this is not going to happen.
David Lee didn't play that game, so Amir Johnson got the start. I think if what we heard, he's going to come off the bench, so I'm not wasting that pick. The thing that infuriates me from a fantasy point of view specifically is that Kelly Olynyk is the best fantasy big man on that team. He might not be the best player, but if he plays, his fantasy numbers, he has legitimate top 50 potential. If he was to play 30 minutes, he has top 50. He can score, get rebounds, hit threes, get steal, block. He can pass. He's a good free throw shooter. He can do it all if he gets minutes. Now, he's going to be a primary backup, because we heard that Jared Salinger is going to be out of the rotation. So if you own Jared Salinger in a standard league, you can pretty much cut him now, because he pissed the team off last season with his, you know, always rocking up late. We know about him being out of shape. And now they've said, well, he's not going to play. Same with Jonas Jerebko. Olynyk's the guy that I want to keep an eye on, because if he gets 25 minutes, that's enough. That's enough for him to be owned. Amir Johnson, if he gets 25 minutes, it's not enough. I think this game is so fantasy friendly, but the only one that I think is a must own is David Lee. Tyler Zeller, if you really need that efficiency out of a big man, and Olynyk if you're just in a deeper sort of format and you want to go maybe upside or if something happens. But for me at the moment, and I can't believe I'm saying it, it's David Lee is the only guy that's really, really has to be owned.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree with that. And the only reason I ask it is, you know, I look through waiver wires at the moment and a lot of these guys are sitting there. And I guess if you can get the jump on other people when we find out who it's going to be and that there is trust there, you know, it could be a valuable commodity that you add, you know, in the lead up to that first week or even 1 week in. And putting those guys on your watch list is pretty important, I would have thought.
Yep.
The other question I had for you is trade strategy. You know, we talk a lot about draft strategy. We talk a lot about, you know, waiver wire ads, free agents, whose roles are changing. I want to pick your brain a little bit because I know my philosophy on it and trying to pinpoint little niches that people need. But what's your strategy on, you know, getting a trade to benefit your team the best, other than using Basketball Monsters Trade Valuer?
And in terms of Basketball Monsters Trade Valuer, that's important, but you don't want to look just at that total number because what it does, it gives you a plus or a minus value on the trade, but you can't go based on that alone because that adds up all the differences between all the Z scores across the categories, but that might not be what benefits your team. You've got to look at all the individual areas. Where are you losing? Where are you gaining? How does that affect your team? For me in trades, I don't do a huge amount of them, and something I don't do, and generally after a draft, I get, you know, people offering trade, how about you trade this for this? And like, I drafted these guys for a reason at a specific point, and nothing has changed since I drafted them. So in general, unless it's something that's really in my favor, I'm not going to do any trades before the draft. And I'm not a big trader in general because most of the trades that get offered to me are things that just don't work for what I need to do. But the one thing that I would put out there as a strategy for people is the first week of the season, everyone shits themselves. They panic tremendously. Oh my God, this guy is terrible. I need to trade him away. Nick Batum, we need to drop him. Brandon Jennings, he played 20 minutes the first game. Oh, I need to drop him. And then he comes out and has a 20-20 game and puts up, you know, 10 assists for 10 games in a row or whatever he did. People panic. People were considering, like, oh, Al Horford, I'm going to trade Al Horford and I'm going to get, I can't even think of a crap player, but they were, you know, trading Al Horford like he was the 80th ranked player because he struggled the first couple of weeks. You need to pounce as soon as someone is having a bad start, and you can always ask me for opinions on trades. But if someone's having a bad start to the season and he fits what your team wants, aggressively pursue it. And if there's someone who is just going, and there are always going to be players who start off the season hot and continue. There are going to be players who start off the season hot and then don't. And a great example was that from two seasons ago, Vitor Favorani from the Boston Celtics started the season. He had 10 blocks in the first two games, and it was, oh, Vitor Favorani, we need to grab him. He's out of the league now in less than a season since that. The first week of the season, there is stupid stuff that happens. Stupid performances, really bad performances from good players, out of their brain performances from bad players. That's when you really need to pounce. Those first couple of weeks, a player who's struggling, especially if there's common sense reasons as to why it's happening, coming back from an injury, and people panic so much. And that's one thing that I say to everyone: don't panic if it's you, but prey on other people's panic. Go out there and offer it lowball, and then negotiate it back. But you can get 20, 30, 40 spots of value on guys because they are really panicking those first couple of rounds. That's my probably number one trade strategy, is try and exploit it in the first couple of weeks. The other thing is don't make a trade just because you feel it's fun to make a trade. Make sure it actually benefits you. Like, it is fun trading and it's fun proposing trades and thinking you're a GM and making these decisions. But don't just go ahead and throw in. I feel that so many people make trades just because, oh, we haven't had a trade, let's do a trade. Most of the time when you do that, you'll end up costing yourself because you're trying to be too smart or you're trying to be too fun or whatever you're trying to do. Don't do it just for the sake of it. You need to go in there and look at how this affects my team. Where am I strong? Where am I weak? Am I strengthening the category that I'm still going to lose anyway? Then what's the point? Really have a look at what it's affecting with your team and do it if it benefits you. Don't do it just for fun. There you go.
Yeah. No, I agree. The one thing I sort of also look at pretty heavily throughout the year is, you know, keeping your ear to the ground and reading things around trade deadline time, you know, making sure you're well prepared about, you know, guys that could get traded into contending teams and have minimal roles. You know, for me, someone that just as a Wolves fan, I think Kevin Martin is a big chance to be, you know, if the Wolves don't start well and aren't in playoff contention this year, I think there's a significant chance that he gets traded this year. For me, if he's the starting shooting guard and he's putting up threes and points and he has value to me around the trade deadline, you've got to be aware of this stuff. You know, you've got to be aware, you know, sell high on him if you think that there's a possibility. And if you hear little whispers from the relevant guys, like following someone like yourself, Seth, all the roto riders that are out there that have their ears to the ground, you know, and there's serious value in, you know, checking your Twitter feed around that time and getting a little jump on the rest of the game, and trading around that, because, you know, you can find yourself flipping a guy that in principle doesn't really give you an advantage, you know, and then after trade deadline, struck gold. So, you know, Rudy Gobert was the perfect guy last year, turned into a top 10 player after the break.
Yeah, exactly. It's keeping an eye and trying to read or listen or see as sort of much as you can to try and get, because, you know, not everyone is going to be as plugged in as what you are necessarily, as what I am, as what half the people in your league. Some people won't be, some people will be. You need to be able to see if you can get a slight hop on those sort of things, and it is possible to do. So keep an eye on that. Now, we did have a question come in from a listener, Trent. I think it's a pretty quick one. I'm just going to bring it up if I can find it. There we go, from Matthew Wang on Twitter, at Matthew Wang with 3 G's. If I'm picking up a big in round 2, how would you rank them? Nikola Vucevic, Pau Gasol, and LaMarcus Aldridge. Now, we already spoke about being a bit down on LaMarcus Aldridge. I would have Vucevic at 1. I would probably have Pau, then I would have Aldridge as the next guys. Although, I don't think that I would want to take Pau or Aldridge in round 2. How do you see those three guys?
Yeah, well, I think he must be at the back end of round 2. Yep. Having someone like Curry or Harden on his roster already, I would imagine, judging from the caliber of guys he's talking about. For me, I rank them exactly how you have. But again, like you talk about all the time, like I talk about all the time with my sort of mates when you're drafting, like it's whatever suits your preferences, whatever fits well with what you want to go towards. And when you mock draft, you know, planning around these sort of guys. But I think, you know, Vucevic is going to be the guy that could go through the roof this year.
I agree.
Gasol, you know, he was very durable last year and performed through the roof, and probably won a lot of guys' fantasy championships. But, you know, I'm skeptical that can happen again. Whether he loses a little bit of time with Mirotic coming so heavily into the rotation and wanting to keep Noah involved, I don't know whether that'll happen. And Aldridge maybe losing some minutes or just, you know, occasionally getting rests that he didn't get when he was in Portland. That's enough for me to think I'm going Vucevic every day of the week. And I think, you know, his defensive stats could improve a lot.
I agree this with year. That. I think that he gets his blocks at over 1.2, that sort of number this year. I think that he is the clear best guy out of that group to me. And a lot of people will say Aldridge. I don't want Aldridge in round 2. I want him maybe at the back of round 3. And I have drafted him this year because I got him in the 30s, and that's the sort of range where I want him. I think I've got him ranked about 35. That's the area that I want him. Vucevic,
yeah,
is a point scoring machine. He's going to get rebounds. I think the blocks go up. He's got superb field goal percentage and really good free throw percentage. He's another guy. I mentioned Gordon Hayward is going to be a first time all-star. I think Nick Vucevic is going to be a first time all-star. I reckon that's something I should do on a podcast before the season starts, projecting some first time all-stars. I think that Vuce is going to be that guy this season. I think that his defense takes a big step up. Trent, I think we're done with this podcast. Is there anything else you wanted to mention or ask me or talk about?
Mate, we've been blubbering on for well over an hour.
We have.
So, give the listeners a break and stop putting them to sleep. So, no, mate, I appreciate you having me on. I hope it's added some value and some insight to people who are listening. And, yeah, feel free to hit me up on Twitter, ask questions. You know, whether I don't profess to be a fantasy expert, but if it's about cricket or any of the other fantasy sports I'm heavily involved in. So, yeah, no, pleasure being on. Thanks, mate.
It was good. Good having you here, Trent. And remember, you follow Trent on Twitter at Copes9. So go ahead and follow him there. And he definitely he loves engaging in conversations about all manner of sports. So hit him up there. Me on Twitter is redrock_bball. Don't forget iTunes. Subscribe on iTunes and leave a review. Thank you to everyone who's been doing that. The numbers have been coming through fantastic. So I really do appreciate that. Another quick plug for Moneyball. Remember to head across to Moneyball. The link is in my Twitter profile and in the show notes. I appreciate if you sign up there and play some daily fantasy against me this season in the NBA. And you can add me to your friends list on there. We can do some contests together. So I do think that's a good idea. And Hardwood Paroxysm, the NBA preview magazine, is out now. It's $4.99. It is massive. There is a ton of articles in there, to which I contributed 2 articles, I think, and I was in 2 or 3 roundtable discussions. So you can check out my contribution there, as well as the other guys at Hardwood Paroxysm, Danny LaRue, Seth Partnow, Ian Levy, who have all been guests on this podcast, Chris Manning, Daniel Lewis, a number of guys who have been on this podcast, plus all the other stable of writers from Hardwood Paroxysm in that magazine. So I do suggest, it's only $5. Go and have a look, go and have a read of it. And there's a stack. It's great artwork and great articles over there as well. Trent, again, thank you. It's been great having you on, great chatting with an insight into the Utah Jazz, into professional sport in general and fantasy NBA. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.